With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All right, I'm going to give you a pre-warning today's podcast. Mm-hmm. It's proper golf. I mean, this is the golfiest golf podcast we've ever done.
Borderline too much golf, if you ask me. So
this is episode number 71. We've got a guest on today, Dan Whittaker, who has been my kind of on and off golf coach for the last kind of 4 or 5 years. Really nice guy. Knows loads about the golf swing, knows about technique. He works with elite players. He gives some really solid advice today on how you can best get to a single figure handicapper.
Yes.
How far you need to be able to hit it. Who's better, me or Pete?
Yes.
I really liked his answer to that one.
Yes, I did as well.
So stay tuned for that. He's just a really nice guy.
He was good. He's still here lingering around. So we'll give all the niceties now. And then later on when he's gone, we can slag him off a bit.
This podcast is also proudly sponsored by our really good friends at Motocaddy. And I've played 2 rounds with my Motocaddy now.
Yeah.
And I've played the best golf of my life.
Is that because you use a Motocaddy?
It has to be.
You know, when you say really good friends at Motocaddy, I would say best friends.
Oh, wow.
Like my, unfortunately now, because of COVID restrictions, my wedding's only going to be 30 people. So you missed the cut, sadly. However, I'm thinking that the president of Motocaddy, if he would like to come, I'll make an exception.
Wow, and you really like Motocaddy.
He can come to my wedding, because that's how strongly I feel about Motocaddy.
Okay. Well, that's fair dues.
Speaking of Motocaddy, if you follow our Instagram, at the Rick Shields Golf Show, which you should do, we did a giveaway last week. Motocaddy said, we will give you another one with a bag for one lucky winner.
They're unreal.
We had so many people enter. We actually had there's 4,930 people.
It's quite a few.
Who tagged 3 friends. And it was a good competition, wasn't it, I think? Why would you not enter that?
It's free.
It's free. And we picked a winner purely at random. So before I scroll down the comments, just landed on somebody. And it was a guy called Ollie Bill Wiltshire.
Well done, Ollie.
So I've messaged him. He's given us his address, which I'll pass on to Motocaddy because they're shipping it, which saves me a job massively.
The best.
And he's won a Motocaddy. So if you want to win stuff like that, follow us at the Rick Shields Golf Show on Instagram because you could win next time. And also, if you want to rate us an Apple, do so. 5 stars, ideally. And then lastly, if you have any emails for us, whether that be a Dear Rick or a Nightmare Golf Shot or just a general question, opinion, or whatever it might be, the email address is...
podcast@rickshields.com.
You're getting really good at that now.
I'm going to talk about 2 things very quickly before we start the podcast. First off, yeah, Thank you so much to everybody who listened and, more importantly, watched last week's episode. Obviously, it was the birth of our new studio.
Mm-hmm.
The comments, the reception on the second channel were outstanding. So if you've not jumped over to the second channel yet, we've got a big mission. We want to hit... We've got a place on Guy's shelf, which is going to be the home for the 1,000 subscriber plaque from YouTube.
On my shelf, because I deserve it.
Now, we've not got there yet.
No.
And I'm actually disgusted with all the listeners and viewers.
For not subscribing.
Yeah.
Make a separate account, subscribe, and do it for me.
So we've got to get to 100,000 subscribers. We're currently on about 85,000 subscribers. And every single week, we put clips from the podcast onto the second channel. A lot of people talk about the full podcast. I'm not sure about that just yet. I think people think they want it, and I'm not sure if they actually do want it.
Or they could pay us, we could put it somewhere under a paywall. That'd also be good.
I like that idea as well.
What was the second thing you had to talk about?
We played golf.
We did. Right, let me just set the scene. We played golf the other morning at Marriott Worsley Park, 8:30 a.m. I was a bit late.
Well, I texted you the night before and said, do you fancy playing golf in the morning? We'll have a brainstorming exercise.
Yeah.
While the lads are busy editing.
Yeah.
And I said...
My brain was hurting by the end of it. It was so stormed.
And he said to us, guy said, yeah, not a problem. I said, 8:30. question mark. And you went, yeah, great. You turned up at 8:30.
Because I've not played golf for that long. Because I'm very punctual. So if you say to me, I'll meet you at McDonald's at 9 o'clock.
I would say that's your biggest weakness. You're too punctual.
Yeah, I turn up at like...
It makes me feel late. Even when I'm on time, I feel late.
Because I get there normally before, a couple of minutes before. With golf, I drove into the car park at Marriott Worsley Park at 8:30 because I'm so used to getting there with you for filming, not actually playing golf. So anyway, rushed the first tee. We played golf. You played the best golf of your life, so that was really nice to see for me. Because it was nice to be there while you played so well, and I played absolutely terrible, and you won, and you destroyed me by 6 and 5. So I absolutely got battered. But it was just nice to be there while, you know, because you spend so much time practicing and playing golf. It's nice to see you actually put it all together and play well. So I was just happy to be there.
You can't even look at me in the eye when you say that at the moment.
I was rubbish.
No, it's good. Nice to get out there, and hopefully we'll do a recorded one time where me and Guy go and play some golf and record it for the podcast.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to get that in nice and early.
Well done.
I beat you on the golf course, but can I finally beat you at rock, paper, scissors? That's the next question. And then we're going to start the podcast with Dan Whittaker.
Okay. 1, 2, 3. You can. Oh, you changed then. Absolute pathetic cheat. What man have you turned into? Win the odd game of golf, and this is what you've become. Yeah, now you can win. Fine, put it on. I'm going. See you later.
Here's a jingle. Enjoy the episode with Mr. Dan Whittaker. All right, guys.
There we go.
Welcome back to Rick Shields Golf Show podcast, everybody. Episode 71. I'm your host, Rick Shields. I'm here with co-host and producer Guy. And we've got a guest today. One of the most knowledgeable, interesting golf professionals in the industry, Mr. Dan Whittaker. That was a better take.
That was a third take, lucky. Well done, Rick. You sound like you know what you're doing now.
We're excited to have Dan on the show today because, one, he's very knowledgeable, knows a lot about the golf swing, and I think he's going to add a lot of value to our audience. We've got some great questions coming in from Facebook, some very tough, hard-hitting questions. You also played golf with me last week.
Yeah.
And Guy summarised your game after 14 holes. What was the word you used?
I said to Dan, I've watched you play today, I've judged you, I've stood here. It's good for me because I'm not playing, so I could look like a player, I could talk like a player. Nobody knew any different. I said, Dan, today, if I walk away from this golf course, I'm going to tell people, Dan Whittaker is a solid golfer.
And would you take that, Dan?
All day.
Because how many times have you played golf in the last year?
That was my first game in 6 months.
Okay, so solid, you'd take solid.
He was a sneaky long. He's got like a three-quarter swing, a little bit of speed in the transition, low ball, like low spin, but he's straight, and he hits the fairway. It's a lot, so much forward momentum. It's unreal.
So much roll. Most people say there's no top spin on a driver. After seeing some of yours, I would almost semi-disagree.
Yes, I would
It almost defined the laws of launch monitors.
It completely did, didn't it?
But anyway, nice to have you on the show, Dan. How would you describe yourself? How do you, if you were in, you know, I'm going to steal that off another podcast. If you were in an elevator, a lift, how would you describe yourself if someone said, oh, hi, how are you doing?
I'd start off saying, yeah, I'm doing all right, thanks. And then they'd probably say, what do you do for a living? If they came up to that bit, I'd say, I help people hit a white ball around a field and hopefully allow them to hit it less frequently.
That's a good answer.
That's a great answer. And then they'd probably compliment your trainers.
Hopefully.
Because you're a big trainer fan.
Massive trainer fan, a geek.
For people in the US, that's sneakers. You've currently got a pair on today, which I've asked you what they are, and I'm just going to say they're out there, quite literally, because you're saying they're from space or something. They have a space background or something.
They're like a Nike Overreact, and apparently they're just a little bit mad.
And nobody can see it on the podcast because we've got this big fancy desk now, so you can just use your imagination to think how crazy they actually are.
You could go out there, couldn't you?
And how many pairs of trainers have you got? I think this sets the scene. I think this starts the podcast really well.
Well over 60.
Wow. All paid for.
All paid for. It's not good, is it?
Wow.
Well, I think Dan's got good trainers. He's got good hair. He's got a good jumper and he's got a good watch on. So far, I think when I grow up, I'm going to be Dan Whittaker.
When I grow up. If you do want to watch the podcast today as well, guys, the second channel is absolutely booming so far. We're on nearly 85,000 subscribers on the second channel. So if you do want to jump over there, see some clips from today, because I think, again, some of the clips that we talk about today is going to add real value and help you, hopefully, play better golf.
Yes. Well, the title of today's podcast, which we've already got before we do it, which is very rare, is Podcast 71, The Elite Golf Coach, bracket Dan Whittaker Guest. So, as Rick alluded to, Dan is an elite golf coach, and followers of Rick's channel and followers of Peter Finch's channel will know you because you've both had numerous lessons off Dan. And what was kind of ironic, Rick, was the last time you had a lesson off Dan was last week. You had a little bit of a catch up with him, and you went on to go and play golf and play the best you've played in a long time. So there's some kudos to you there, Dan, that you helped inspire him. One of the things I thought from your game this week on the Break 75, Rick, was you played well. You shot 1 under gross. You were very confident, and you are a confidence golfer. I think the fact you started off well helped that, but I also think going and seeing Dan, having you, did you stroke his ego a little bit, Dan? I think that's what he needs sometimes, a little bit of just a little cuddle. Little belly rub.
He's a very good ego stroker.
Nice. That's part of the job, that, though, isn't it?
No, it was. If you've not seen the latest one, we played at the Mere, which I think I was comfortable in many different regards. Mm-hmm. One, it's the third episode, so yeah. The first two I kind of got out of the way, got over the little bit of the initial kind of nerves. It's a golf course that I know really well. I was an assistant pro there for like 7 years. And the people around us, you know, played, known Dan for a long time, known obviously Matt, Harry, and you came around filming, and it was just very relaxed.
There was a certain vibe.
It was an afternoon. Somebody said in the comments, have you had a beer before this round?
Hmm?
And I must admit, looking back at it, it did look like I'd had a bit of a beer.
It was chilled, but we had a lot of dialogue with Dan, so some on camera, obviously a lot off camera, and we said, Dan, we need you to be our first guest in our new podcast studio, because we talked a lot about golf, a lot about things outside of golf. And we thought that the wisdom you have, the knowledge you have, and the way you can articulate yourself would be a great podcast episode. So let's start at the beginning. Let's start with Dan Whittaker. How did you start playing golf, and how did you get into golf?
So started playing when I was 13. Dad played golf, and he just happened to say, do you want to come down and have a little bit of a go? But when I started, you couldn't actually start playing until you were 12. So I kind of did a few shots in the garden when I was dead little. Wasn't really interested in it. So
when you say that, you couldn't start at the golf club that you were going at,
yeah,
until you were 12.
Until you're 12, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, well, that rule's changed now. That
yeah, it has changed. Yeah, I think it's like any age now, but I think it was. I don't reckon it was until early 2000 that it changed.
Oh God! Really? Well, I'm glad it's changed now, but like I say, it's not good if a golf club isn't allowing juniors to play. So anyway, you've got there at 13.
Super archaic rule.
Yeah, you got there at 13.
So I got there at 13 and then just literally got bitten by the bug. Just sort of found that, you know, you were in control of what you were doing. I was into playing football quite a lot before that. Used to get like frustrated with all the players around me when they weren't pulling their weight or weren't doing what I thought they should be doing.
Let me try and describe Dan as a footballer.
I think you would have been, are you right-footed or left-footed?
Right-footed.
Definitely a winger.
I was going to say right side on the wing, bit of pace.
So started off on the wing, but actually didn't quite have enough tricks. So okay. I ended up moving back to fullback and was just one of these super annoying fullbacks who was rapid and you couldn't get past. And then just...
like a Roberto Carlos.
Yeah, but probably a bit dirtier.
So and not skillful.
Definitely not skillful, but I definitely loved it. Obviously, I'm like tiny and everyone was miles bigger, so they'd think they could sort of bully you, and I just loved getting stuck into it. A few elbows in the ribs and things like that as you're going along. That would just set the tone nice and early.
So as you transitioned into golf, you couldn't do the elbow in the ribs and you couldn't bully people off the golf course, I guess.
No.
And you got bitten by the bug. And then kind of set the scene, first handicap, do you remember?
I think it was like 24, something like that.
Yeah, and then came down pretty fast.
Yeah, so by the time I was 16 when I left school, I was off 4.
Okay.
So I got down relatively quick.
And as a 16-year-old Dan Whittaker, were you the same as every 16-year-old off single figures? Did you want to be a tour player? Did you want to be the next big thing?
For a little bit, but I had like a strange thing that happened. So at my golf course, a lad called Neil Pabari, who was an absolute baller when he came to playing. So he just missed out on the Walker Cup, the one that Dyson and all the, like Luke Donald, all them boys played at Nairn. And he was at my club and he practiced loads. So I practiced loads next to him. So my long game was pretty solid. And he turned pro and did absolutely nothing. Literally starved to death. And I was like, yeah.
Wow.
If he can't make it, he's miles better than me. So I thought, do you know what? There's no chance of me doing it.
Yeah, I probably needed that type of golf.
100%. Well, what were you, so you were off 4. What was he playing off then?
So at 60, he would have been probably plus 3. But he was 3-4 years older than me. So when I turned pro at 19. And then when I was like 18, I was playing quite a lot of golf with Pabs. And it just... he turned pro, and I was also playing golf with a lad in the area called Dave Brunton. I had a few lessons off Dave, and Dave had played European Tour, and it was, we'd go out and we'd play, and I did it pretty much the same as Dave. He wasn't that long, but he was just dead, dead solid, but we'd go out, and I'd feel like I played pretty good, maybe shoot a couple under, and he'd not really done anything, and somehow shot 5 under, and you go, There's a bit of difference.
So do you think if you were playing another club without those really good golfers around you, you might have fell into this trap of thinking, I'm a good golfer, I'm going to make it on tour. But because you had those kind of bigger fish with you, it was quite clear that they were a different level.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm.
It is interesting, that, isn't it? So I think that one nugget of really good golfer ahead of you massively dictates as you as a golfer what you do in your future. Because again, when I was a junior at my club, there wasn't that player that was like ridiculously better than me, and I kind of somewhat wished there was. It was only when I went to college and I realised, oh crap, there's actually a lot more better golfers now.
I like it when you paint this picture of you as being like 16 at the golf club, because I imagine your head would have been so big. I'm looking at Rick's trophies now from his net fourth place runner up who tried the hardest medal, and he's really proud of it. But were you cocky though, Rick? We've shown up this. Did you think truthfully now that you were the best thing since sliced bread or not?
Set the scene again. When I was like 14, 15, Jay Lindenberg coming out. Mm-hmm. I had the brightest clothing.
Yep.
I had the beanie when it was sunny, and I wore waterproofs again when it was sunny, bright coloured waterproofs. I used to have a bag with a straw coming through the strap that I used to drink, as I've talked about in the podcast before. I was a cocky little...
You know what vibe I'm getting with you? I feel like around your home track, you might shoot the odd like level par.
I wasn't that good. I wasn't even that good.
What, we're saying then five over
yeah,
par?
Yeah, I was like five over.
Goes to Junior Open, shoots 92.
100%.
Blames the condition of the court. The greens were rubbish.
That was me. Come pick me up, Mum. I don't want to play here anymore. I quit playing golf. Yeah, that was definitely me.
Yeah, but yeah, similar to me.
I wish I had, like say, that better player in front of me, because I think that would have either done one of two things. It would have concentrated my mind and gone, that's what you're chasing, that's what you've got to work hard for. Or it would have just gone, you're nowhere near here, Rick, so sit back and do something else maybe. If you can't play, coach. It's probably what I moved into. Did you ever have inspirations of coaching at that point in time, or when did coaching start to become a thing?
Remember we used to have these club matches sort of around the Mersey Valley. So we'd have like five clubs and you'd do home and away matches. I remember a guy who was the pro at Withington, he'd just come back from America and he'd been doing a bit of teaching over there, probably quite a lot of teaching actually, to be fair to him. And I remember after the match, I'd actually played unreal for me. I'd looked at a few sketchy shots, but actually scored unbelievable, won pretty comfortably. And when the bar after, he goes, that technique's not standing up, you know. So I'm going, yeah, you're probably right.
Said that to you?
Yeah. And then he asked me a question. I can't even remember what it was now, but it was like something to do with the golf swing. And I somehow completely blagged it and actually gave him a pretty good answer. He went, yeah, it's not the right answer, but I really like the way you thought about it. And he said, you know what? If you want to be starting teaching the game, you need to get to know a little bit more. And then from that thinking, I thought I could sort of blag my way around it at that point. And I thought, you know what? I really need to step it up a bit. And from then, I just started to want to know more and more.
So from that point then, how old are you at this point, sorry?
19, maybe 20.
Looking to maybe do your PGA at this point?
Just turned pro on the PGA.
Okay, so you were going through, and then it was that pathway as a lot of PGA pros have to make. Do they go down the line of coaching? Do they go down the line of playing? Or do they go down the line of being a head pro, for example? And you kind of saw the pathway of moving into coaching?
A little bit, but what actually I actually turned pro, and then when I finished my exams at the weirdest time, the Trafford Centre golf range wasn't open. The only range that was either Altrincham or Stile, going to a range wasn't really a thing. So it was still, if you went and had lessons, you had it off a club pro. Mm-hmm. So I went and got the club pro's job at Mobley and was there for 3 years and built my own indoor studio there, had the cameras, and sort of like built from that, and then got to the point, a couple of things happened at the club. The club got broken into, you know, they'd cancelled my insurance on the shop without telling me because they were broke. So I'd lost like 30 grand's worth of stock, managed to sort of sell a load of other stuff and pay off all the invoices that was owed, but sort of went, you know what, don't want to go through this position again. Really like doing the teaching. I'm already getting quite busy with it. And then an opportunity came up at a range in Altrincham. And I actually went and took the job there. And the instinct was, I'll do this for 2 or 3 months and I'll just keep my eye out for a club play role. And then never just wanted to ever do anything else ever again after that.
Wow. That's quite... It sounds like... What year would that have been then until you got broken into?
2005, 2006, somewhere around there.
So you were kind of quite early on to the whole cameras thing. Because that feels like the whole cameras and really kind of being like... analytical with our golf coaching is something that really feels like probably 2010 it really kind of got into its own. So you were ahead of the curve a little bit there then.
Yeah, I remember. She used to have a video recording camera that you put a cassette into, but you didn't use the cassette. You used a Firewire cable, and then you had to have an adapter that went into the side of your laptop. And then you sort of had that going in, and the cameras were super clunky. You hardly saw any frames, but you were the only one who could let people see the golf swing. So you were sort of semi-revolutionary at the time.
Wow. I remember going for a lesson when I was a junior at a driving range, and similar to what you're saying, they used to record my swing on a proper camcorder that used to have a little cassette in, and then you put that little cassette into a bigger cassette, like a VCR cassette, and you put that into it. We used to go back into the actual shop then. So this was like 5 minutes after I probably swung the golf club. He'd then put it into the cassette player, put it onto a TV, and then get a pen, like a whiteboard pen, and actually draw on the TV.
On the actual TV screen.
And pausing it and doing it in stages and drawing on the TV. And then when he wanted to wipe it off, he'd just get a cloth and wipe off the screen and then do it again.
That's outrageous.
But like, I was seeing one golf swing. I'd maybe do a few warm-up shots, do a golf swing. You do all this process, which might take 10 minutes. We then go back out, and I'm thinking, I've seen my golf swing, but I can't see it every single time. Now, it's a given. Like, you in your studio, and your studio is pretty awesome. You record the golf swing from four different angles, or three different angles, from back, front, top.
We can do four, but I mainly use roof, mount, front view down the line.
In, like, seconds, and every time you record it, you're there. Yeah. And you can play it in super slow motion. The camera quality is amazing, everything. And you can draw lines, you know, with a computer and all that. But, like, it's come on leaps and bounds in that time frame. It's amazing that golfers haven't improved vastly in that time frame.
No, that's the thing. We take it for granted now, don't we? Like, GC Quad, launch monitors, all these lessons and stuff. But like you said, it's one thing getting told what you're doing wrong, but then, and we'll come on to this a lot more depth after, it's then the actual practicing that, isn't it, and improving on that. Because you must see so many people, well, maybe not actually at your level now, but you probably have done, seeing people who come for lessons almost every week or every 3 weeks, but don't actually practice in between. And that is obviously where it is key.
Yeah, I mean, I've now got like a little thing in my head that if somebody wanted a lesson twice a week, I won't teach them. Because I don't want to just watch them practice.
Because there's no time for them to practice in between, is
yeah,
there?
Yeah, I don't... They could pay me a lot of money for just standing there and watching them practice, but they're going to get nothing out of me, and I'm not going to get any enjoyment out of it, so I'm not going to give my best to that situation. So that person, I'd just rather not teach.
I feel like I've got loads of questions to ask here. One of the ones I want to ask first off is, how did you now, after all those years of coaching, obviously at Mobley, then Altrincham, and then you moved now to locating at Highley. How long have you been at Highley for now, actually?
In my sixth year now.
Wow, that's come around quick.
Yeah, no.
What now categorises yourself, I suppose you do yourself, did you start to move into elite coaching only? Because I'm guessing it wouldn't have started at that level. Like you kind of specialise yourself in, and summarise for us, the audience, what do you classify as elite players and elite coaching now?
So aspirational juniors or amateurs who want to potentially have a career in the game, that's one big part of it. Pros, and then from amateur standpoint, it would be, I'll have some still mid-handicap guys and things like this, but they're generally the ones who are going to really, really put the effort into their game. They're going to go practicing a lot. They're going to be sending you a lot of videos. You know, when they first get in touch with you, the first email that drops, you kind of know the person you're going to get. So it wouldn't be unusual to get one that is literally like War and Peace about their golf swing. Mm-hmm.
So you say no to clients?
Yeah.
So clients will email you and say, Dan, I've seen you on Rick's channel or whatever it may be. Can I book a lesson with you? Like, do they have to go through like a screening exercise or how does that work?
So I'll send a couple of comments back to them, see what I get back. And then from there, it'll then move into getting you booked in.
Right. If you decide that they kind of fit for you, really.
Yeah, kind of. I think there's loads of people out there that do give great golf lessons. And I'm quite fortunate. I'm pretty busy. So I can almost pick and choose who I want to have in. And I want it so that I'm so engaged in the lesson when they're in that I'm giving it 100% of me. So they get the best out of me, they get the best value for their money, and they get the best for their golf game. If it's somebody who just wants a quick fix, a quick tip, they could probably pay me double, but if I wasn't interested in it, I'm going to give them a rubbish lesson. And if that's the case, I kind of now recognize within myself that That's not something that I want to be doing and want to associate myself with. So I'd rather say no to that person than take the money.
You're almost trying to build a stable of players, aren't you, really, I suppose, from 100%. Like, say, aspirational juniors to professionals and to elite players.
Yeah.
And you want to see those players develop over time, over years, over their career, basically, don't you?
Be on the journey, yeah.
Where a lot of pros, you know, I used to see it at Trafford when I was a coach at Trafford. You'd get some of that, definitely aspirational pros. But then the next lesson was Barry the Builder, who just came in with his driver, fix my driver now, I'm slicing it, I need to fix it, I'm playing in an hour. And you're like, oh God, the contrast is so different.
Yeah.
I actually really enjoyed that type of lesson. I really got a lot of kick out of that quick fix lesson. I saw myself as much more of a quick fix coach, and I loved that. I really did. Where obviously you've kind of gone through that and now obviously streamlined it into kind of the elite players, really. On a different topic, but similar, let's say now, right now, loads of people listening, if you're a junior golfer now, and you're passionate and you want to get good and you want to become a tour pro, right? What advice are you giving them?
So what sort of level are they already going to be at? Let's just start there.
There are Rick Shields,
yeah,
at 14.
So what, like?
Playing off 9 or 10.
Right, okay. So first things.
thinking he's all that.
Okay.
With his Jay Lindenberg pants on and his sweatbands.
First thing is, how hard do they think they have to work?
Okay. I play twice a week,
yeah,
and I maybe go to the driving range once or twice a week.
Okay, so you're probably going to have to go into the driving range. So a lot of it to me would be managing their expectation level on what the standard is that's out there, and now what do they do that's good, and how are they going to bridge the gap between what is seen as excellent out there at the top of the tree, even within junior golf, and then going further again after that, and where are they at, and how do we bridge that gap? So it'll be... First things will be like all the things that have nothing to do with golf, like how hard they're going to work, are they willing to do the gym, are they willing to do all the other little bits to go with it. And then after that, if we're looking at the golf game, it's going to be based on probably having a look at where their raw skills are from club head speed, what sort of club delivery they've got. And then after that, if they're happy to do all the things that it takes to get there, I think you can develop them.
And what does it take? How many hours a week are we talking? What is there a benchmark? Is there a formula for 14-year-old Ricky Shields? I'm going to rewind time back to when I was 14 and take this information on board. How would I have changed?
Surely there's got to be a level of actual just pure talent as well.
There has, but how many have we seen that have turned pro that or got to 18 that are unbelievable? The most talented you've seen, and all of a sudden, got the trappings of life. They can go out, they can have a few beers, they can go and get some birds, they go and have a bit of a laugh with the lads, and all those things pull them away. I believe the development years are actually 18 to 22.
Right, okay.
Because that's when you can make massive, massive strides on them. Because if you happen to be in a national squad at that point, you're going to get less of those trappings. You might fall away a little bit in your mid-20s when you've suddenly made a few quid and you sort of can just do whatever you want. But in that 18 to 22 bracket, if you're right on the edge of being really good, but you're going out and you're doing all the things that then take you away from being great at golf, I see that being the key, the big difference.
So if you want to make it, you can't have any fun.
No, you can have some great fun, but you've got to be... They've got to be dedicated. There's so many people out there trying to make it. Now, I think that the talent field is bigger than it's ever been. The amount of spots out there are less than ever. And the standard is an absolute joke.
Do you think it's harder now than it ever has been before?
100%.
And why do you think that is? Is there a reason?
I think now that to get someone good, there's actually some, not a formula per se, but you know, if I go back to just me with coaching and now it's, I could coach the individual almost completely just on how they are built as a human being. So, you know, what their structure's like from their arms, their shoulders, what their mobility's like, what's the dominant eye, what's the dominant leg, how they're predisposed to move, what tightness have they got, you know. And then you can basically then build a pattern and build a golf game around that one person. And there's a lot of really top-notch coaches out there that are doing this. So you can get someone good really quickly.
And is this why we're now starting to see on tour, I suppose this isn't anything new, you see like your George Gankus and coaches like that, that develop like a Matt Wolf,
yeah,
or someone like a Victor Hovland, or, you know, even a like Xander Schauffele or Bryson DeChambeau, like none of them have got, let's say, technical Adam Scott golf swings anymore.
Yep.
They've all changed, haven't they? They've all developed to that individual, I suppose. Matt Wolf being probably the prime example of that.
Or even that Zalatoris, you know.
Of course.
There's so many, you know, idiosyncratic things that he does, but he matches them all up. So, it's, you know, he'll do certain things that he'll match up with a movement somewhere else. And his coach obviously knows what makes him work as a player. And it's just make him the best version of him. Now, there's certain things that you'd go, well, that's not right for you, and we need to change it about. But gone are the days where, you know, you go for a lesson and the guy just pulls up Ernie Els from 2001 and then compares it, is the club face position halfway back. That's gone. That is completely gone.
To put this in some perspective then, we obviously know that if you're 22 trying to get on the European Tour or whatever it might be, it's obviously about what you've won or, you know, qualifying for your Q school, etc. So handicap is becomes irrelevant. But just for our listeners, what would you expect a 22-year-old guy to handicap to roughly be if he's that good, he's going to get onto the tour and make a living from it?
Between plus three and plus six.
Plus six?
Yeah.
Wow.
And you think that's going to, like, proper make it? Or is it...
It's got a chance.
Wow.
So if you're off, like, scratch, that's amazing, but that's just essentially six shots per round away from where you need to be almost.
Without me being rude, I've got 16-year-old kids who are teacher who are off plus two, plus three, plus four.
Flipping heck.
So, crazy, you know, if you're 22 and that's and you're at scratch, it's still a really good standard. But, you know, you are, if you're off scratch, how many times are you going out there shooting a couple under?
Yeah.
Okay, well, the guys who are off the plus numbers, their bad days a couple under.
Mm. I think that's something that certainly more casual golfers kind of forget, because obviously we know that when you turn pro, you don't have a handicap, and scratch is essentially a zero handicap. So people see that as being the same, that a tour pro is a scratch golfer. But actually what you're saying there, you've got to be off about plus six in reality to actually have a chance of making it on tour.
Well, you look at even the golf that's happened this weekend at Harbour Town, and Stuart Sink won. He's not a spring chicken. Was he in his 450s, I think? The first two rounds he shoots eight under, sets the 36-hole record. Like, these, and that's at Harbour Town, a ridiculously hard golf course. What is a tour pro's handicap if they were a Saturday weekend golfer at a Hiley or a Marriott or so, just a nice lovely golf course?
Plus but eight.
They really would be, wouldn't they?
Maybe plus nine. But what we don't see is that the golf courses they're playing are monstrously long.
Yeah.
The greens are rapid. All the runoffs around the greens are cut so fine that you find the most horrible positions to chip from. And yet they're making a mockery of a golf course that is, we might go around there the day of the event, and if we've played all right, we'll probably shoot, a scratch player's probably going to shoot between 75 and 80.
Yeah, well, I've played in a few pro-ams now on the Wednesday and had to play off the back tees, because a pro in a pro-am, you have to play off the back tees. It's like, it's so hard. Like, it's literally, I can hit an unbelievable drive on some of these par fours. I played at Wentworth and the BMW Pro-Am, and I had to play off the back tees. You can kill a driver. You're still 200 yards away from the green. And you're thinking, oh my God, I've actually hit that pretty good, and I'm miles away. And then you get near the green, and the greens are rapid and fast, and putting on them is hard, chipping on them is hard and everything. And you think, and you look at the scores that week, and I can't remember what it was exactly, but I'm like 15 under for the week. And you think, I don't even know how they've done that.
You know, another question then on these guys that you have that are elite. I feel like I know the answer to this, but when we say, like, these guys want to make it, in my mind I'm thinking European Tour or possibly PGA Tour. Do you have many guys that actually just want to make a living from golf, who just want to go on the Challenge Tour or even the EuroPro Tour? That's their aspiration, and they're kind of quite realistic with that.
Yeah, you get a few like that.
Is that refreshing for you, or do you want them to have their aspirations even higher?
No, I actually like that, you know, and because they might surprise themselves and get there. But, you know, they're probably pretty good at their own expectation management at that moment in time. And if they get to, you know, one of those tours and they can make it so that they're in the sort of top 15, top 20 spot, somewhere near there, they're probably going to make a pretty nice little living. But they're going to have a great lifestyle, traveling the world, going to different countries, playing mega golf courses. But I think the ones that find it so difficult is that they have to make it. They financially have to make it because they're really struggling. That then becomes really difficult. So you get some guys who I've known a few over the years who have turned pro, absolute ballers, and then they've gone out on one of the tours. Now all of a sudden, this 3 footers for your dinner. So it's a different thing. So then they miss it, and then a bit of scar, mental scar tissue comes in, and then the following week, this one's again for your dinner. And now you've had a year and you've not hit it that bad, but your chipping and putting hasn't been quite as tight as you might have liked, or a couple of other things have been off, and all of a sudden you're 30th on the money list and you've lost money. And you do another year and you lose money again. And then you've got a missus who wants to move house, and you're going to move in together, and you say, well, this isn't going to work, is it? You're losing money every single week and every single year, and it's not going to work out. So I know a lad in the area who did that, went back to amateur, and within 2 years was off plus five. And everyone's getting like, turn pro again. He said, it's can't do it when I'm putting for my dinner.
Yeah, if you're putting to win a weekend comp and get 37 Staleford points, it's a bit different to literally paying for your mortgage, isn't it? And then these elite guys that you see, I'm guessing obviously there's many pieces of the pie, and obviously you're a big part of that pie, but like, how, what's the kind of, say if I'm a 22-year-old, I'm off plus five, and I'm potentially going to be a good golfer, I'm seeing you, how often are they then working out? Are they seeing a golf psychologist as well? What's kind of, what's a typical like lifestyle?
What does the team look like now?
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool, that, because I see it as quite a nice collaboration approach now within the coaching. I've got a couple of different physios within the area who I recommend people to go and see. I've got one person for the golf fitness. Then we have one or two people for the club fitting. That bit's a bit of a difficult one sometimes, because you want someone to go and get the right club fitting, but you also don't want them to just totally just being sold to that you need the most expensive, this, that and the other. It's what's the best thing for your game. So that can be a difficult one sometimes. Then rather than just a pure golf psychologist, I'll sometimes bring someone in who just does performance coaching. So I can do the performance coaching, but I'm so busy that it will dilute what I'm good at. So the guys who do the performance coaching, that's all they do, and they're absolutely brilliant at it. So I'll get them in and we'll collaborate on that. I'll do a lot of the stats work and things like that for the player and help to dictate what the practice will look like. And then on the other side of it, we'll also occasionally for some players we'll use like a putting coach, because that's all they do for a living, the putting coaches. They're going to be brilliant at it, they're going to know more than I do on putting, so that's the guy to go and see for that.
And that's something that's changed over the last few years, I think. I think you have to be really comfortable in your business to start sending your clients to other people, other businesses effectively. But when you're looking at the holistic picture of how do I make this student better, well, it does take a bit of everything. And like you say, you can manage one thing, yes, really, really well. But there's so many other elements to the pie. And you mentioned on club fitting a minute ago. I mean, that's just a huge element of the pie that I deal with all the time, with reviewing equipment and everything. And you're right, are they going to get sold the right equipment? I suppose a lot of these juniors now, a brand starting to like sniff around these juniors a bit more as well now, and starting to like go, come on, little Johnny, I'll fit you out with all the Callaway gear or Titleist gear. Or does that happen?
Oh, yeah, that happens.
And does that happen at an early age now?
Yes, yeah, so some are getting given kit fairly early. If you get into a national squad, you're definitely getting given clubs and probably getting given some clothes, and you're getting pretty well looked after.
And then, you know, obviously they want a return on that to some degree, I guess. They've got to perform or...
Yeah, you just keep being you, keep improving, trying to get better. And if you do that, you'll keep that, the brand will like you, they'll keep going forwards with you. And the hope for the brand really is, as much as anything is, it's a numbers game. They keep giving it out to various people. Hopefully, some of them then will sign with them when they turn pro.
Question for you then, Dan. Don't know if you want to answer this or not, but I'll try it. So you're obviously a golf coach, you're based at Hylee, you've got obviously, as you said, a number of clients, and that's obviously great. Is your ambition just to keep that business going and keep it successful, or is it the hope that one of these clients gets into the European Tour and next thing you're obviously travelling the world with them or with a handful of coaches? What is the kind of dream
for you? I'm really
glad
you've asked this question, because it was one that I was thinking myself.
Yeah.
So I'd love to know your answer for this.
So I would like to have some tour players, but I don't want to be travelling the world every single week with them. I'd want to choose the events that we'd go to. I'd still want to be doing what I do at Hylee, because I love what I do. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm really fortunate. I go into work and I love what I do. The day bombs by, it's great. So I would want to pick and choose the events I'm going to. I don't want to be where the player, you know, you're there just sort of micromanaging them. So I actually build into what we're doing early on that they can start to become their own personal coach. I'll help guide them from a distance as well. Yeah. But that's why it goes back to the thing of me saying, I don't want to see him twice a week. I want to see him every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of the elites I'll see you know, every week, but maybe even that will be mixed up. Some of the pros, it'll be 2-hour sessions every couple of weeks.
And you're like a WhatsApp chat with them. They'll say, oh, Dan, I've shot 81 today, or I've shot 76 today, done it. And then you'll just text them back. Is that kind of thing you have as well?
So I have that. Then we'll have, so there's a stats program I use called Golf Stats Coach, which is basically, it just does all strokes gained. So as soon as their round goes in there, I get a notification. So I'll go on it. I'll look at the strokes gained. I'll then phone them up, talk them through that. But if they need some help, which I want them to do, I say, look, I expect 3 videos a week off you. So I kind of, at the start, I'll say, right, here's how we're working together. I use an app called Coach Now, and your lesson notes are going to go in there, but I want you to put a video in there. Okay, I want a couple of videos a week, up to 3 a week. And if you're scared of putting more in there, don't worry. I'll say to you, please stop sending videos. You're annoying me, right? But I'd rather have that, right? So I want someone to send me more videos, not fewer. And that's how we'll communicate on the golf swing through that. And then after they've played, it'll be stats and then talking on the phone.
Just quickly, on that relationship then, it sounds like you've kind of got to like the person that you're coaching. What if somebody came to you that's +5, got great natural skill set, and they've got the potential, but you just think they're an idiot, you don't get on with them, would you still coach them, or do you have to get on with them to some kind of level because you want that constant communication, or can that just be put to one side?
I think it can be put to one side, but I think you can develop the relationships, because it might be where they first come in and they're maybe a little nervous, or they think they're just maybe, you know, they're that best player in their area or whatever, and then it just maybe it's going to take them a little bit of time to grow into themselves to realise that there's other people out there that are probably better than them.
And just the last thing, I've got this in my head as well. Have you ever had it where you've had a client for a long period of time and you find out they've been and seen someone else for a quick lesson?
Oh, yeah.
Because that must drive you insane if that's happened.
Yeah, I have had that, yeah.
What happened then?
I've had it a couple of times, to be fair.
Like a little one, as they've come clean and said, look, I've been to see Rick Shields, or like you've kind of found out through us.
I went for a quick fix to fix my slice with Rick.
It would be more of when it's happened, it's more, okay, what were you struggling with? Okay, you want a different perspective, a different viewpoint. Yeah, this is what I got from it. Do you know what? That might be just, they might really suit what you're doing. And at that point, if they think that's the right thing, I'm quite open to say, you know what? They might be a really good fit for your game. Go and try them again. See what they do. The door's open, you can come back, not a problem. It's not, I've kind of, as time's gone along, I think my ego's gone so far out the room, it's untrue. So now I'm just quite cool about it.
There must be some point that we would close the door. Because it was, I always forget what Rory's new coach is called.
Pete Cowan.
He's, I think, got some rule in place where if you leave him and does, what is it? If you don't do something, he won't see you again.
Yeah, if you leave him and basically, he wants a return on investment in the future.
Yeah.
So if, let's say, Lee Westwood decides to leave him.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. You can leave, but in between now and when, if you were to come back, you have to pay me a percentage to keep the door open.
And then it closes if you don't do that.
If you don't do it, you never see me again. You can never come back to see
quite
me.
Dramatic.
As a golf coach.
Have you ever closed the door then, Dan?
No.
I think that's the rule, by the way. What would it take, or who would it take, for you to quit everything and coach on tour? Would there be a player? So picture the scene. Rory, ring it up. I'm trying to do. Hello there, Dan. It's me, Rory.
Oh, crikey.
What accent is that?
I don't know what that was.
It's me, Rory. No.
Sounds
more like Shane Lowry. Okay, I'll do Shane Lowry. No. Hey, Dan. It's
Jamaican.
It's Shane.
I didn't know he's from Jamaica.
I have no idea, really.
Do it in your own accent. Just be Rory.
No, let me do it. I can do it.
Oh, this is getting worse.
What? Give me a line that you can say. Top of the morning to you, no. Hey, Dan. It's me.
That's Jamaican.
I really feel like I've offended all the Irish and Northern Irish listeners. Rory rings up, says, hey, Dan, I've heard you on the Rick Shields Golf Show podcast. Really like what you were saying.
Really like trainers.
Love your trainers. I think you and me could be a really good fit. I want you to be my full-time golf coach. I want you to travel the world with me. Obviously, I know family and commitments, everything else. You name your price.
Oh, Christ, there we go.
To some degree.
Or percentages.
Would you do it?
Be a fool not to actually go meet, and probably, I think something like that would happen where it talk to you. You say, "Come over, okay? I'll come over to wherever you are. Spend 2 weeks together. Let's see where we're at, and let's make a decision after that." I think that would be a no-brainer to go and have a look at. But I think also you have to look at it from the other standpoint of the longevity of just working with one person from around the whole world. What happens if all of a sudden he gets fed up with you? He don't like the colour of your trainers anymore, you know? So he then just, all of a sudden, you are unemployed. Well, you can't just go back to Hiley and say to someone, no, I'm here again. Do you want to take it back?
Yeah, but could you though with Rory?
You write a book.
But
you
no,
bring a book out.
On a serious...
My year with Rory.
Obviously, I don't know Hiley at all, and you clearly do know your clients, but surely if it's someone like Rory and you came back and said, look, tails between my legs, it was arguably the best golfer in the world, or certainly one of, would they still, do you think, be like, no?
I think if you got a player of that ilk and you perhaps got two or three other players at the same during that year together, then it would be a no-brainer to stay going out there. But I don't feel like I want to travel the world every single week. I kind of had this in my head a bit ago. It was a bit like, you know, I'm married, I've got three kids. I don't want to not see my kids grow up, if I'm really honest with you. So I would love to be coaching players on different tours. You know, I've got a few girls on, you know, various levels, but I'll go to the odd event, but I don't go to many, and I'd like to
just keep that a bit more still, sorry Dan.
I'd like to go to, you know, a few events and the big ones, but I don't think I want to be travelling every single week and not see him grow up, if I'm really honest with you.
I've got another question then, and this might be too far, so do, I just got interested, but feel free to tell me to F off. So obviously, if you're coaching now a guy that's plus five, but he's only 17, let's just say, or a girl, whichever, obviously, doesn't matter. They're obviously amazing with amazing potential, and you might see them every 2 weeks, like you said. But that hour that you give them, or whatever it might be, and then that coaching throughout the week on messages and stuff, for that hour, surely they can't be paying much more than another client. So how does it become kind of financially viable for you to invest so much time in somebody when they've actually not got any more income than Dave down the road who plays off seven?
So what I do with the up-and-coming juniors, full-time AMs, is I charge them all a junior rate. So I don't charge them as much as adults. So it's actually, financially, it's not a great business model.
Yeah.
So if you did it, as you know, if you wanted to make more money, get rid of all of those up-and-coming players, fill it with loads of mid-handicappers, and, you know, up the prices.
So then what do you have in place? Do you have something in place if you do turn pro to make it?
Yeah. We have something where it's more of just a verbal agreement in terms of when you're on tour, you know, if you get there, here's what could happen. But it's not really a big sit-down chat with them at any point with that. For me, it's, I really enjoy coaching them. I really enjoy the journey. I want to help them become the best they can be. And if they end up making it and we both end up profiting financially in the future, brilliant. And if not, it's just great because I really enjoy doing that. So I think that it got to a point a few years ago where I sort of financially thought, I'm happy with the number I've got now.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't need to be any more than this, but here's what I want to be coaching. Here's who I want to be coaching. Here's what I love doing. I want to go into work and love what I'm doing every day. So it's not totally bottom line. It's about the quality of player that's coming in and how much I can help them.
Must be a level of trust there then. I know you said it's for the fun of it and enjoyment, but there must be a level of trust that, you know, you could coach one from being 12 years old to 20 years old. They could get on tour and get lured into one of these big massive name coaches that you see on the tour that looks glitzy and glamorous.
Definitely that.
If right now, I'm going to go back on the tour story.
I like these little questions.
If right now, okay, to that scenario of Rory, let's just put that to bed for a minute. Let's just say right now, you could pick three players on the European, on the tour, PGA Tour, European Tour, whatever, to coach. I want to know what three players and why would you pick those three?
Oh, that's a good one, isn't it? I like that.
And it can't be particularly about money. So it can't. Okay. They're all going to pay you the same, regardless of what happened. Which three players would you coach?
Probably go Spieth.
We do the why next, and then goes into the next one.
Yeah, go on. Why Spieth?
Okay, so Spieth, do you know what? I love the fact that every single shot he grinds over. Mm. I feel like if you work with him for 6 months, I think you'd learn so much more about that you could help other players with, because, you know, that sort of relentlessness that he has, he never gives up. You know, he's trying as hard over a 3 foot putt that he's already missed the cut on, like a bit like Tiger with that, as he is on the one that's to win the tournament. Love that. So I think there's so many little bits. I believe his golf IQ in terms of like the sort of strategy, the knowledge around the course, the different bits, I've heard that's off the chart, so I'd like to experience that a little bit firsthand.
Do you think you could massively improve him?
I think I could definitely help him, yeah.
Okay, player number two.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So there's, if you heard of, I don't see who came. There's an Australian lad who is...
Miwu Lee.
I'd like to work with him.
We're actually doing some filming with him soon.
I'd like to work with him. I think that'd be cool. Because, do you know what? I think his talent is off the charts. And I definitely think I could help him.
So and there you've gone for someone super, super well known, super well established with major victories.
Yeah.
Who has kind of fallen off the beaten track a little bit. But certainly right now as we're recording this podcast, he's very much back on the road to recovery.
Yeah.
So that's one player. You've also gone for a lesser known player who has won out on European tour, yep. An unbelievable player. And then who's your third player?
That's a good, really good one.
Would you go for someone with more of a wacky swing? Would you go for like a Matt Wolf? Would you go for a... No. Would you go for, is there a player out there that you don't ever feel has reached their full potential?
Yeah, there's a few of those.
And is that something that you'd like
tell
to
you would
into?
Like to work with? Bit left field on this one, but you'll go with it. Ricky Fowler.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because he's a baller, but he isn't right now.
He is. He's proper dropped.
But that'd be a cool journey. If you end up getting him back to winning and you got him back into the top 10, all of a sudden you've helped him rediscover himself. He's unbelievable on the greens. He's just not swinging it great at the minute.
I like that. That's a win-win because if he gets better... Oh, his new coach, Dan Whitaker's the best thing since sliced bread. If he's rubbish, oh, well, he's on a decline anyway. He can't learn a new coach. So it's quite a safe bet.
See, I think I'd go... I feel like you're going for... Not the wrong word. Is like, with Spieth a little bit, certainly with Ricky, a little bit damaged material. Like, you can get them back in. If it was me, I'm just going DJ, John Rahm, and Tiger.
Yeah, Tiger's a no-brainer.
I'm just all for the easy road.
Dan's given us a nice, good answer, educating. You've just gone for the best golfers in the world.
Because I can just sit there and go, yeah, that's good.
You can sit there and scroll on Instagram, yeah, swing, that's fine. It's like Happy Gilmore, it's all in the hips. Rick's just there scrolling, have the biggest, strongest thumb in the world from all this right thumb action.
I'd get some banger Instagram videos and stuff. Oh, just coaching DJ again today. Oh, he's gone and just won again. Oh, please.
Speaking of good swings, though, and swings that need improvement, I've got a really good question off Facebook here for you, Dan, and this is one that might be a Facebook clip, so it could get good views. Graham Murray has asked, and I want your hand-on-heart answer here, whose golf swing is better? Peter Finch or Richard Shields?
Wow. I get full Sunday title.
You do. Oh. And let's elaborate it as well. The longer the clip, the more ad revenue, so it's better.
And you can forget you're on the world's biggest golf podcast right now, the Rich Shields Golf Show podcast. That doesn't influence...
I can forget that you're the host of it. And I can just openly say what I want.
That doesn't influence anything that you're about to say now.
So, what are we... Are we going to use the answer based on how good they are at controlling the golf ball around the course and it sticks under pressure?
Oh, no, or, then Pete probably wins.
Or is it the one that looks and technically seems the best? Or can you have the two?
You elaborate. You take
tell
time.
Me, Dan. You tell me if you think there's more than one option.
Okay,
more than one, if Rick wins at least one option, then we're fine.
I think there's two answers. Okay, so I think if you looked at it just from like old school kind of hitting positions, moving through it, controlling the ball in a sterile environment like on driving range or just when it's a free go, I think Pete's really good. You know, I technically it's a good move, but I don't see Pete being brilliant under pressure. And I think that it's because some of his skills have been learnt skills and he maybe just hasn't had enough time to be able to do it under pressure, whereas Rick kind of owns his move, so he's definitely more of a balanced player that goes with the confidence. But because he owns it, if he goes a couple under, it's a chance to go six under, but I don't see Pete getting that far under because I don't see him bouncing with it.
My burn. Man.
Burn, Peter Finch. I like that, Dan. So you basically said I'm much better. I think the biggest differences are, and I do think Pete's got a really good swing, and you've obviously developed that enormously. He had a very classic-y swing when I first met him, and you've kind of developed it into much more of a power swing right now anyway. But you're right, there's many times where I feel like my kind of gritty kind of almost getting the ball around, not all the time, granted I've had some shockers, but getting the ball around definitely works in my favour a little bit more, where I do think Pete as a longer lasting golf game right now is a lot better because he's putting so much more work and practice into it without question. Match play, I think that's where I kind of really can find my own in match play, hence the two trophies on the cabinet just up there from 2002 and 2003. I do think match play is where I kind of get that gritty, like, little bull terrier type mentality.
I think you're doing yourself a bit of a disservice there, mate. I think when I look back, before I, you know, worked with you, maybe about 3 months before, you went and won an event at Old Links.
Yes.
6-7 under?
No, I think I was about maybe 4 or 5 under.
What event was this?
I think he knocked it on the first and hold it for two.
Back in the day.
Did you win a PGA event?
I came second. I was 3 under through two at St. Anne's Old Link. So I eagled the first, birdied the second, then went par, birdie, birdie.
Is this why you wanted to play there for the Brick 75?
Yeah. The frigging wind picked up. No, but I do think...
But that sort of like tells me where you're at, if you get what I mean, in terms of you're really comfortable. Once you've got yourself going, you're quite happy to go with the flow.
I'm a very confidence player, as you mentioned earlier.
I think you're a confidence player, and you can go deep once you start. If you're 3 under par through 9, you could be 7.
Yeah, I'm not 100%. Scared about that. Like, once, if I do start, if I'm playing well, I never ever think I'm going to blow it when I'm playing well. When I am playing badly, though, all I think about is blowing it on every single hole. That's my biggest difference.
Yeah, so your brain gets in your way when you're not playing well, but when you are playing well, you just roll with it.
Yeah, gets this, but if I start well and get through the front nine, I never think I now need to just hold on for the back nine. I definitely, if I'm playing well, I'm like, okay, back nine, I'm ready to go more now. Where, like I say, when it's playing badly, it's just like, oh God, come on, where is that magic? Where is it? And I think that's just part of me. I don't play as much. I don't practice as much. Obviously, I'm doing a lot more this year with the Break 75s and just playing a lot more in general and really enjoying it. And you know, just that little bit of advice I got from you last week, even just with the club face and the chest turning, just a little glimpse of just something that's like a little stroke on the... like
a little
say,
belly rub.
A little belly rub and a little... You're all right, Rick. You're not as bad as you think.
Question for you then.
Whenever I go into Dan, he's just like, he's just so much better than Peter Finch. I think that's the big... like. And I
walk
out...
Well, he was slagging Pete off when we played the other day, wasn't he, how rubbish he is. So.
And I just walk out there going, I am better than Peter Finch. Yes,
and then you
go.
Play against Pete and he beats you 5-4. But what I was going to say was, from what you saw with Rick the other day at the Mia, when he played solid, and you obviously played him, he shot 1 under, dead tidy. If... From that performance, you have Rick for 12 months, every couple of weeks. He actually puts it, proper grinds it. Let's say his handicap right now would be, what would you...
I would say I'm about a 3.
At the moment, what do you think you could get him to in a year? I know there's a lot more to it, it's a bit of an open-ended question, but realistically, if you put his mind to it...
To base it off like the new system, which is really based off of where you're at with your current game, plus 2.
That's impressive.
Yeah. I'd take, for me, I don't travel very well. My game doesn't always travel great.
You get in your own way when you're travelling places sometimes. I think you're a lot better than you think you are. I think your short game needs a lot of work.
Hence, yes.
Your chipping's the worst bit, innit?
I think my putting's good.
You think your putt great?
I think my putting is good.
Your long putting's mega. Distance control's good. Obviously, hit it long. Iron play was really good.
Yeah,
I feel distance like control was good.
Irons and putting is good. Chipping and wedges is crap. Driving is okay.
I think 120 in game needs to get really good.
Yeah.
And the thing is, as good as you hit it, you've got a lot of them. So they just need to get tighter with proximity. Need to be able to control the trajectory a little bit more on the wedge. You'd be able to fly it in a bit lower, controlling the spin. And then around the greens, you need to just be having it where when you do miss, it's just average shot, 3 foot. That's what it needs to get to.
I don't have that, unfortunately, at the moment.
So next up, Dan, we have a section every week called Dear Rick, where people can write in a nice email or a nasty email, whatever they fancy.
And it's powered by our really good friends at Motor Caddy. By the way, how good did I play? Use my Motor Caddy?
I think that's what it was. It wasn't the lesson with Dan, which was all right. It wasn't the belly rubbing. It wasn't the fact you know the course. It was the Motor Caddy.
I've played two rounds with the Motor Caddy.
Yeah.
I'm under par.
What happened in the second round when you played the Motor Caddy?
I beat you. Six and five.
Yeah, you did beat me 6-5. Beat me 6-5. I played rubbish. But I felt refreshed. I felt energised during the round of golf.
I like how Guy's just taking a hit there, just so we can get the Motor Caddy ad reading. That's respect that to the co-host and producer there. So that's a... Yeah, that's class.
So everyone that writes into our Dear Rick, we can do it for over 10 weeks, and each one, at the end of the 10 weeks, gets put into a hat. The name will get drawn out. One lucky winner is going to win a Motor Caddy, and then second place is going to win a Motor Caddy bag. So it's very much worth sending your email in for the chance to get it read out and also win that trolley or bag. If you want to do so, it's podcast@rickshields.com. This week's Dan, I've handpicked because I think I want your input. So it is Dear Rick, but it's Dear Dan, which weirdly has a better ring to it than Dear Rick.
Dear Dan.
Maybe going forward, it could just be Dear Dan. We'll actually get Dan in just for this section each week. Anyway, it says Dear Rick and Guy, brackets.
And Dan.
And Dan. First off, I want to say thank you to you both for your great content. Thanks. After having an on-off-again relationship with golf since I was 15, brackets, I'll be turning 35 in a couple of weeks, so 20 years, quick maths. I have recently started playing more consistently since becoming across your Facebook and YouTube channels, etc. a few months ago, and I am now in the process of working towards getting an official handicap, and I want to start entering a few comps at my local course. So we hear that a lot, don't we? Nothing out and toward there. But my question is this. I have a few $100 to spend to improve my swing and my game, but between online training programs, training aids, lessons, or going to a PGA Pro or new clubs, etc., I'm at a loss of what could be the best course of action. I feel like every aspect of my game could use improvement. So what would your advice on getting the biggest benefit be out of all those above? That's from Jeffrey.
I'm going to just cancel a few out before passing it over to you. I wouldn't spend a couple of $100 on training aids if you don't know what you're trying to fix, personally. And possibly, again, it sounds like you're in a good spot where you don't particularly need to spend loads of money on clubs. And a couple of $100 maybe not going to make a massive difference to your golf clubs.
Okay.
And it sounds, you know, either way, I think going into lessons or a development plan is kind of more beneficial. But I kind of hand that over to you, Dan.
I do a bit of research in the area where you are and try and find the coach who's got the best reputation, and then do a bit of digging about on what they can do.
How do you find the coach that's got the best reputation?
First of all, it sounds a bit of a cliche, but often where a lot of the good players go, a lot of other good players tend to go. So there must be something that's happening at that place, or somewhere where you've seen friends of yours going and they've been improving a lot. So it's one of those two things. So it's either a recommendation, you know, and often, you know, your club pro, not being a disservice to the guys who, you know, are club pro, they've got so many other things that they're doing that they are going to slightly water down what they're able to deliver from a golf lesson. And I think you want to make sure that the person who you are seeing is pretty good on being able to figure out what's going to suit you as an individual, you know, because I think that's massive. I've seen that change a lot in the last sort of 12 months. Maybe 18 months, but it's all very much about here is, it's, you know, it's just a case study of one person in front of you. How do they move? What do they do? And try and find a coach who can help you as an individual get the best you can.
So best reputation and somebody who can work with you.
Yep.
I think I would look at social media as well as a kind of a way of not asking on social media. I think that a lot of people make that mistake of putting the golf swing on Facebook and saying, what have I done wrong? But asking, like having to do a bit of research, let's say there is three or four golf pros in the area, check out the social media, see what they're putting out there. I mean, we're going to come on to this in a minute, but Dan was you were doing YouTube before I was doing YouTube.
Yeah.
And actually seeing, is there any content out there, or even just tweets or Facebooks or whatever, do you feel like you'd have a bit of rapport with said coach and who can actually develop you and bring you on?
Well, I've asked that. That feels too easy, doesn't it, so far? So there's a reason why I've asked you this question, because obviously you two, both certainly down at the, you know, coaching a lot and PJ coaches, that was the answer you were going to give, which I expected. And I agree with, actually. But the reason I've asked that is because I often see these comments online where people almost, it seems to be a thing of like, go and get lessons, which obviously makes sense. But I think, I might be wrong in saying this, there's a bit of, people think that just by having lessons, you're going to improve. Now, there has to be a lot more to it than that. An analogy I'll use, rightly or wrongly, would be if you were overweight and you wanted to get fitter, well, go and see a personal trainer. But going and seeing a personal trainer once and then never going to the gym again is going to make no difference whatsoever. So you've got to carry on either seeing that trainer every time he goes to the gym, or at least working out a couple of times a week and changing what you eat. Just by, as good as you two are at coaching, I'm looking more at Dan here, but just because somebody, no, because he's obviously coaching still, but just by going to see you once may possibly obviously improve your golf massively, because you might change something fundamentally that just goes boom and it works. But there's going to be a lot of graft, a lot of grind, which you obviously, with your clients, are lucky because they do that. But what else does somebody have to do? They don't just go and see a coach once, do they? What do they have to do to actually improve?
I think that, well, I wish, probably the right starting word is, I wish there were people out there who, when they saw the person who comes in for a lesson, is almost manages where that person's expectation level off the bat. You know, and like you said, going to the gym, that's almost a bit of an analogy I sometimes use, is saying, you know, if you decided you want to start on a weight loss program, just because you've eaten well for one day, expecting to be a different weight tomorrow. No, it's the decisions that you make today, what you put in your body, how you do, how often you go to the gym, what you're going to do, are going to turn you into the person you want to be in 3 months. So the golf journey might take you 2 months, might take you 3 months, might take you six. It all depends on how quick and pliable you are as a student to keep getting better. But it's more about, you know, what are you happy to put those efforts in to get where you say you want to get to as your goal? So you've got a goal here. Here's, you tell me what you want to achieve. I can tell you how long it's going to take you to get there. Tell you what it's going to require to get there. If you're not happy to do that, we'll need to reassess your goal and then change the landscape relative to you.
And is it common? I think it is. But is it common for certainly higher handicaps who've got habits ingrained over years to actually get worse for a little bit before they then do get better? If you change your grip from a very kind of strong grip to what feels like a really weak grip, surely you're not going to play great golf the first time you play.
I always found this cliche when I was coaching, even students coming in, and they'd always have this impression, I know I'm going to get worse before I get better. But I actually really disagreed with it.
I do.
Does that not happen very often then?
It depends on what you're changing. So as a golf coach, me and I'm sure I can talk for Dan, like, you know, it's like a puzzle. And at the moment, you can see how you're going to create the picture, but you're not going to just dive in straight into the most crucial part of that puzzle, say, hence a player's grip.
Yeah.
Because that player's grip, he might have had for 20 years playing, as this guy has. It's like, that's a very sensitive thing to change. So we're going to change. I might tell the student that, right, yeah, Here's three or four things I feel like you need to work on, grip being one of them, But at the moment, we're not going to work on grip, because your grip's really strong and it's actually helping you currently right now. We need to change something else before we change the grip. So I think it's just being very, very sensitive, certainly around grip issues, because when you do change your grip, it feels awful for a player. They often do hit it worse, much, much worse after. But when you change your grip, you have to marry those kind of almost two wrongs making a right often at the time. Like you call it matchups, don't you?
Yeah.
Like you have these matchups in the golf swing, and if you change one matchup and don't change the other, it can be disastrous.
Yeah, you've got to change two things all
the time. You've got to change two things. So it's understanding what those two changes are, really.
Makes sense.
So yeah, I would totally disagree with that that comment that you get worse before you get better. I don't believe in that.
I completely agree with you there, mate. But I've got it from the other side as well, in that, you know, if you go back 10 years ago, there was like a golf grip pretty much that you taught. This is the way you should do it. You go back to all the books, they all had a way to grip it, and it was all really, really similar. Whereas actually now, you know, it takes about 10 minutes to start the lesson where I just run through a load of tests. And it's really, really quick. While I'm having a coffee, just run through it all. And I can tell when I've done those tests, what the grip is that's going to be right for them based off what their shoulder rotation is going to be, while their arm flexion is going to move, and you can tell straight away what the grip's going to be like. And if the grip is really strong and that's how they're predisposed to move, well, I know that there's going to be certain swing characteristics that have got to fit with that. Now then, at that point, if they've got something in there that is a complete mismatch because they want to take it back, just as an example, keeping the club head looking at the ball for longer and outside the hands, whereas actually if they've got it really strong, it's going to work inside a little bit more. Well, that's such a bad fit that then if I say, right, let the club work inside a bit more. Oh, well, I actually did better when I did that. Yeah, but it's not like an Instagram swing that you will have watched, or it's not, doesn't look like Adam Scott, but it's great for you. And then at that point, what's the next bit that fits with that? Well, at the top of the backswing, let's say that they don't make a perfect hip turn, they move off it a little bit. Well, okay, we need to get you loading a bit more into that right side. Bang, all of a sudden, they could quite quickly turn from it in a cut to a draw because it fits in with their grip based off the fact that you're matching things together.
I often think, probably wrongly, that a lot of elite golf coaches, which obviously you are, would look down on golf YouTube videos because they're so kind of one size fits all and stuff like that. But obviously you, as Rick alluded to earlier on, have been making golf YouTube videos longer than Ricky even has. So obviously you do them or have done them and whatever. So what's your thoughts on them then as well?
I think they're really good. I'm going to be doing more again this year. For one reason or another, I didn't do as many last year. But I think that they're really good. But I think that from the student standpoint, unless they know what their fault is, they could be trying so many things that are not applicable to them. And they might get super lucky and just stumble on something. But it's not the YouTube's community's fault that the information's put together in that way. It's just that, you know, it's just how it is. You know, it'd be only the same as looking at a golf magazine, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that month's tip, we go and try it.
I always summarise it as the coaching online, certainly that I try and deliver on Facebook, on YouTube, is almost like more like paracetamol or ibuprofen. They're like little quick fixes. They're going to get you through it and give you a bit of advice and hopefully help you play better, but it's not like massive keyhole surgery, which is where you need to go and see a proper, you know, in-person golf professional to get those major changes. And I think that's the problem. The slight problem now with YouTube is there's so much medicine available and there's no pharmacy at the start of it to go, okay, this is what you need, this is what you need. Because all the information is there, and I watch loads of coaching videos and they're all amazing. But like I say, as a golfer coming into it, and it's like, oh my God, it's like a sweet shop. Just give me all those bloody drugs and I'll take it all. But actually, like I say, you end up overdosing a little bit. Got quite deep. But
you die. There is a place for both, though, because obviously, again, you two will know this and advocate this. There's nothing better than going for a one-on-one golf lesson with a proper golf coach. But so many people might live somewhere in America or whatever. There's no golf coaches around, or they can't afford lessons or whatever it might be. Or they might have confidence to go and see somebody for whatever reason that might be.
Big time.
So there's definitely a place for both. It just interested me that I probably wrongly feel like elite golf coaches often would look down. Do you feel like that, Rick, or not?
I do, I've experienced it. Not down so much, but I've had... There used to be an old Facebook group that I was part of, and it was like a golf pros only Facebook group, right? And I was in there as well. So it's one of those groups where you often have to, you get accepted by the admin or whatever. This is donkey's years ago on Facebook. And I remember some of my videos showing up on there, and like, or other YouTubers' videos showing up on there. And suddenly underneath, you get all these kind of proper golf professionals, elite professionals, just ripping everything into it. I can't believe you're saying that to all these people. It's like, I know, but again, what you've got to understand, it's very generic information. It's not wrong information, it's just generic. And that's what they were kind of getting at. And that's not going to suit every golfer. I get that.
Well, you know, the best golf coach videos that we think about is the ones where it's like five things that good golfers do, whatever, because obviously fixing a slice, as good as they are, there can be different reasons why you slice it. You obviously know that much better than I do. But so many kind of newer golfers, little simple things like watching, if you've got your putts near your opponent's putt or whatever and they hit first, get a little look at the line. To us, that sounds like second nature. But to a new golfer, they might not even think to do that, where they could learn so much valuable information by watching how that putt breaks and the pace, etc. Little things like that, for me, what I think add real value to people.
Like practice drills or little tips. Or yeah. That's kind of, like I say, it's not keyhole surgery online coaching. It can be quite kind of tailored, it's more generic, shall I say. That's interesting. I hope that answered his question.
But I also would say, you know, the guys who are out there calling it, it's pretty simple for them, isn't it? You know, if it's not that good, you get a camera and you go and make it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You get that, you know? As well. So, to be honest, I'd left that group soon after and never heard of them.
Well,
again.
Speaking of kind of generic advice, I've actually had a question, Dan, that I want to hear your take on. So Douglas has asked us, and I don't know if you can answer this, but I think you'll magic something up. What's the easiest fix for more distance? So we hear now, and something else we can chat about, so much about this whole distance debate. People need to hit it far, and it's more important to hit it long than hit it straight, and the Bryson story, etc. So, well, it's two questions, actually. How important is distance in this modern game for the average golfer, let's say, because that's who's listening to this podcast, really? And also, how can people hit it further without even seeing you? What's a magic trick you could give them, if you can?
So, in terms of how important is hitting it long, massive now. But that, you know, I was talking to you last week, mm-hmm. when we were going around, and I see it as there's actually a formula to hitting it long now. There's about six different components that you can put in, and you can figure out which is right for the person. And you can quite quickly gain, you know, really, really great distance up. I mean, you look at Bryson, and it's been the fact that he's using force plates, and they've used some biomechanics, and they've had a few other people in, and basically they've used a science approach to get him to hit the ball further.
And protein shakes.
Shed loads of them. And, you know, in terms of when you look at it, you'd say, well, you've got making the stance wider. So making stance wider actually helps you to create more torque, a bit more turn.
So again, to summarize it, wider than shoulders.
Wider than shoulders, yeah.
Okay.
Then there's a thing called a counter move that you see Bryson do. Matt Wolf does it a little bit. Well, he does it a lot, actually, where they push into the front foot to then move over to the right foot. So what happens is that if you saw any other athletic sport, if you saw American football, running backs, or football, you know, Premier League, someone wants to go round a player. If they wanted to move left, they push off the right foot to move to the left quickly. So it's the same principle. It accelerates the first move back quickly. And then as you do that, if you take the club back as quickly as you possibly can, what happens is, from a technical standpoint, as you get it to that top of the backswing, as you go and change direction, you're putting more force through the handle. So because you're putting more force through the handle, you have to do that to slow the club down, which increases the power that you're going to put down the hand path into the ball. So they don't need to know what it's all doing, but that's the technical reason why they're doing it. So if they speed up the backswing, they're going to hit it further. Wider stance create a bit more torque. Counter move is going to help create that speed. The other one would be...
Let me summarise counter move a little bit better. So what you're saying is, once you set up to the golf ball, you'd almost slightly either push into your left foot if you're right the golfer and then pull back,
yeah.
Or do you mean more like sway to left as you pull back? Just nope. Summarize that a bit.
So you imagine that you've almost got like half a tennis ball underneath the front of your left foot, or it's like an accelerator pedal pushing down into the front of the left foot as you move across.
So you're trying to think, is there any other sports that really, like I say, you probably
tennis, serving.
Mm-hmm.
So you throw
they lean onto the front. They lean onto the front foot and then tilt back with the upper body.
Okay,
yeah,
great. Makes sense.
Okay, and then actually the same thing that they would then do is let the left heel lift in the golf swing at the top of the backswing. If you've not got enough flexibility, what that does is that creates a bit of what's called unweighting, which is people talk about vertical force quite a lot. It means that you can create a lot more of that. So those four bits in backswing are absolutely massive for power.
Wider stance, push from your left foot before pulling the club back.
Yeah.
Pull the club back, swing back as fast as you can.
Fast as you can.
And lift the left heel up at the top of the backswing to help you get more
that
rotation.
That last one looks horrendous in my opinion, though. I know it's a bit of an old school move, but it doesn't look aesthetically pleasing. No. But
left heel to help you get more rotation as well as vertical force.
Can do, yeah.
Or just mainly more for vertical force.
Actually, a bit more rotation coupled in with it, yeah.
And when you're talking about vertical force, you're talking about coming down in the golf swing now.
Yeah.
You hammer that left heel down into the ground, as then everything synchronises back
on
the way down.
What actually you're doing is you're going into the front of the left foot with the vertical force, so you're going right into the very, very front of that foot. And the bit that is, it's actually dead easy when you get your head around it, but wherever you put the force, you move in the opposite direction.
Okay.
So if you want to open up more, push into the front of the left foot more, because there's only so far forward you can go into the front of that left foot. Conversely, you'd pull into the back of the right foot. You'll have seen on Instagram, you know, the guy who hits the golf shot on the ice and falls through the ice.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, it's about 6 inches behind it, falls through the ice.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. When you watch it, what happens is, when he starts the downswing, his front foot slides towards the ball. His right foot pulls backwards, and that's actually what's creating the rotation. But because there's no friction, because he's on ice, he falls over and hits the ice and falls into it. So that movement that he actually makes, I've got that on my in my teaching software, which I'll occasionally use to demonstrate how the forces are working. So if you then pull into the back of the right foot, push into the front of the left foot, you're actually then more on top of the golf ball. And then the reaction from that is right foot rolls over, left foot jumps backwards. The vertical force you've pushed down with takes you upwards. And that's how they absolutely smash it. And it's that. And then it's getting the combination of all those bits.
Sounds that simple.
This is why I can tell Dan's a proper golf coach, because I thought he might just say, turn your hips more or something. But he's actually got like a proper like form. Is that the 6 points then, or is there anything else?
Yeah, that, the downswing is where the weight's five. So it would be how that is created in the downswing. So the big one is then that downswing, as you're pushing forwards, if you can keep your upper shoulders back. So imagine you split your torso into three sections. So you've got lower body up to pelvis, pelvis up to your sternum, breastbone, mm-hmm. and then breastbone above. Well, the body's really good at separating from the breastbone. So what you do is if you separate from there and keep the left arm, keep the shoulders back, the left arm tightens against the ribs and actually creates almost a little bit of extra coil. And that's then huge for getting the extra power.
Is this what they always talked about with like Rory having like this double hip turn and all this? And,
yeah.
You know, he separates his lower body and his upper body stays a little bit more closed.
Yeah.
Helps you also hit more on the inside, helps you hit more on the way up as well, which is much more good for, obviously more beneficial for deliverable numbers with your driver.
Yeah.
Sweet. Was that six? I think we got those, didn't we?
That was good.
I'm going to ask you a quick question, and I'm rewinding time a little bit. We're going to go back to technology.
Yeah.
Of coaching, right? I want you to tell me which tool you love using the most. Just one tool. If you could only use one tool to coach with,
video.
What would it be? Video. I'm going to ask you another question. Which tool do you think hampers golfers' ability to improve the most?
Launch monitors.
YouTube. Yeah.
I think video.
Really?
Yeah. Because I think too many people, I think as a golf coach, I think video is phenomenal. I remember when I started using video, I was at the Mia, I was on the driving range, the water driving range where we were on the other day, and I had a guy there and he had this massive overswing, ridiculous, right? And I was trying to explain to him, you've got this big overswing, it's not doing you any good, blah, blah, blah. And he went, I don't. I'm like, no, you do. There's no video or anything mm-hmm. at this point, no iPhones or anything. I was on a Nokia or whatever. And I was like, you do? He's like, I don't. I was like, oh my God, right, okay. Well, let's work around this. I'll book you in for next week. And, you know, anyway, in that period of time, I managed to get a camcorder. I managed to show him his swing the very next lesson. And he didn't believe me. He literally would not believe me that was him. I was like, are you? So I was showing it him. I was like, that's your overswing. He's like, it's not, is it? Anyway, I started telling him to swing shorter and help him like become a lot more connected with his swing. There was benefits for it. I wasn't just trying to make it aesthetically pleasing. And I was showing him where he's swinging in his positions and that and the other. And long story short, he managed to shorten his backswing and did actually get a lot better. But I think we now live in a world where aesthetics of golf swing from Instagram and social media and everything else almost overpowers golfers' ability just to overlook that and think more about deliverable numbers in launch monitors.
Which I think that's changed though with the likes of what you said before with Matthew Wolf and all these other guys. I've got it more funky swings because it's more obvious that it's about how it works impact.
But I think also like I see on Facebook and Twitter and everything else, how many swings that people sent, oh, what do you think about my golf swing? How do you think this looks? And like people are just going on about looks when they reply back. And I'm not saying the replies should carry any weight, but I think so many golfers now, and I've experienced it with you when I've come to see you for a lesson, I can absolutely strike when I'm like, oh, that was pure, I love that. And the launch monitor numbers look good. I'm like, that's pure. And then you show me the swing and we're working on something specific. I'm like, oh no, I've not got it. It wasn't right. And that almost like makes me think bad. Mm-hmm. As a golf coach, you need to see it though. I just don't think the students should always see the swing.
Yeah, that's probably fair.
I think the students should be selective of when they're allowed to see the swing a little bit.
Do you think the average golfer cares what the swing looks like? Is there numbers that they're getting on from the round of golf?
I personally think average golfer really cares what the swing looks like.
Oh, see, I don't. I think the average golfer wants to shoot the best score they've ever shot and how it looks comes second.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right there.
Oh, I'd be surprised.
You know,
you're thinking of an Instagram world, don't forget, where everybody's
I live
aesthetic.
In Instagram world,
exactly.
I think
of the average guy that goes out and shoots his bet, has 10 pars and 6 bogeys and shoots whatever, score that, you know, and a couple of birdies and shoots 4 over. Is he going to be bothered about where he was, like, here? Or is he going to be bothered about, look at that, what I shot today?
See, I've got a little thing in my mind where I see that some coaches don't still don't work with how to get the student moving better to produce reliable results that are giving a different change in consistent numbers or reliable numbers on a launch monitor. And they're basically, they're just still giving the old golf lesson that they gave 20 years ago. They just happen to have some data on what the path's doing. So what they can do is give them some sort of movement and some sort of alignment that changes the numbers on the launch monitor, which has enabled them to make those changes quicker because they've got data to work with. But it's still the same old load of rubbish that they're being taught. So for me, I think that the launch monitor, really the job of it is, it tells me what I can't see. I can't tell you whether you've hit 4 degrees down or 3.5 degrees down. No way I could do that.
No.
I can't tell you whether you're 2 degrees into out or 1.5 degrees into out. I could tell you whether you're 2 degrees into out or 8 degrees out to in, because, you know, your eyes are going to tell you all those sort of things. But it's dialing it in that I see as being important. And it's more, if I have a belief that it's more from the golfer's standpoint, it's, you know, it's you can control your body, and then which moves your arms, which then moves the club, which then moves the ball. So what if we change how you're moving, we can then change how the club's delivered and how the ball, the outcome is, which we can then start to see, is that having a difference in the data, yes or no? Whereas if you don't actually look at how the person's moving, you can change the numbers just by move ball position the back, get them a little bit of weight on the front foot, you know, fudge it about a little bit, all of a sudden you're into out, boom, there you go.
But isn't that good though? Is that not?
That's great for quick. That's great for quick fixing.
Is that not performing results?
100% it is, but it's just that's not what I want to be coaching.
The other thing I hate with launch monitors is this obsession with like speed and distance now. Because when we play, well, when I didn't play, when you just played the other day, and I was walking around, you two on a launch monitor, Rick would win hands down on ball speed, distance, and stuff like that because he hits it harder. But actually, in the real world, there were so many holes where you were level. I think you even did him a couple of times down. Because you were hitting it with low spin, accurate, getting the bounce off the fairway, which in real life results in distance, whereas Rick might have hit it faster, but hit the rough to the right and hit the, you know, not rolled out. But you don't see that on a launch monitor, do you? You just see speed, launch, spin, and you get so obsessed. It's like I asked you the other day, again, speaking about Pete again, like we did earlier, but he's obviously on a quest now for distance and smacking as hard as he can. Is that going to actually work when you get into golf comps and courses?
Well, I think if you use Pete's example as the, you know, the bit for the sort of the story, as you like, is that if he was playing on the PGA Tour, him searching for a bit more distance would be great. It's 7,500 minimum every week. It's 90% of it's in the air, and hitting it further would be huge. But he's playing in the North region. The longest golf course is probably 6'6". He already hits it miles for those golf courses. So why does he need to hit it any further for those golf courses in those events? Surely for me, it's got to be more a case of what do you need to do to compete at those events and start winning? Because hitting it further is not going to make any difference. You know, local golf courses in the Northwest, they're generally a little bit tight and fiddly. So he's hitting irons off the tee a lot. So surely they'd be better off spending time, because it's how many hours you've got in a day. You know, he's busy with all his business things that he's doing. It's what would be the best use of the time to give the results. I get it as a fun project, but I don't see it as it's going to deliver results in a tournament.
Time will tell.
Interesting.
Bit of goss there.
But equally though, like we're saying, not what sounds better, I clocked out at 1.35 club head speed today. It sounds great, doesn't it? But
from a business standpoint of growing your social media, creating videos, it's brilliant. But there's a huge difference between that and being an elite performer and performing in events.
You know what? And that's something that when even Rick plays and I'm walking around at the minute, I say it so many times, you hit a drive that splits the fairway, we're happy with it, it's, you know, it's in play. But on a launch run, you'd be like, oh, a bit bottomy that. It's only swung like 108. Yeah. But actually, all these things matter. And obviously, when you're getting coached, clearly it matters. But actually, on the golf course, the most important thing for most golfers who aren't elite professionals, keep it in play. Don't lose as many balls. Hold a few more putts. Cut down on three putting. Hit it a bit closer. And you're going to play good golf, aren't you?
Have you got a number? I think this would be really interesting. How far does an average golfer have to be able to hit the golf ball with driver to be off single figures?
250.
250 yards of carry.
No, total.
So 250 yards of total distance.
Yep.
You think that would set them up to be comfortably into single figures?
I use this as a perfect example all the time. My dad will not be impressed with me when I do this, but never mind. He'll have to take it on the chin because he's had it a few times off me over the years. But my dad hit it about 2:30 with driver. Right? And it was so unimpressive. Right? And he just basically chipped his way around. He was a really good short iron player. Tidy short game. And he was off between 4 and 5 for years. And he didn't hit it, in relative terms, didn't hit it anywhere. So for me, if you want to get to single figures, it's not about the distance. It's about being really solid or all the things.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Next follow-up question then. Everyone listening right now, okay, has 2 hours a week to practice, which is probably too much. I don't know. I can't think, you know, obviously people got busy lives and things like the other. For those 2 hours, what should the majority, the average golfer, be working on genuinely to see improvements in their scores?
That's a good question, that. An hour on the range, but split. So they need to know what they're going to go there to work on. So part of it will be just working on pure technique, making sure that they're ticking the boxes of what, in my sort of wording, is. So what makes them be great.
Let's say they've got 100 golf balls to hit in an hour.
Yeah. Okay.
How would you break it down?
That sounds too many straight away, doesn't it?
I don't know, is it? Do you think it is?
No, that's probably what they do, isn't it?
It's more than 1 minute, though, isn't it? It's a lot, that. But that's what I'm saying. Would you advise that? That's what. But for me, if I get, I'll be honest, 40. Yeah, 40's a lot for me. I'll be honest, I get bored.
I get bored.
If you're taking a practice swing and looking at a target,
it's 2 hours, 100 balls, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd say, let's say it's 100 balls. Okay.
Well, no, let's give us proper advice. An hour. How many balls should
an hour? I'd say 50 balls an hour.
Okay.
Okay. First five, just warming up. Getting a little bit hand-eye coordination.
You hit all the crap ones then, don't you?
Yeah.
The ones with no dimples on.
Leave the Dunlop to the driver. That's what I do.
So you get those one out of the way, just a loosener.
Yeah.
Would you have done any stretching?
100%, yeah.
You'd give some stretching advice?
Yeah.
Okay.
So they'd have a warm-up. Like, it wouldn't be a mad one, but they'll have some sort of warm-up. And then that'd be just having like a TheraBand in the bag, just do a little bit of rotation movement just to get going. First five balls, just hitting it just to get a bit of hand-eye coordination going on strike. Then I'd spend the next chunk of time just working purely on your technique, and I'd be videoing it. You should have been given the instructions of what you need to be working on, so you know what to be looking for based off what your tendencies and your faults are.
But again, there'll be people listening that haven't had that advice.
Yep. So that's what I think they should be doing.
Okay. They should be getting some level of advice.
Yeah.
Okay.
They should, after a golf lesson, you should know what.
But I'm saying people listening might not have had a golf lesson.
Okay. If they've not had a golf lesson, have a look at what if you can video it and you sort of are going online and you're seeing what are the correct moves. Are there things in there that you've seen that has been explained in your YouTube or Instagram videos or the tutorials you've watched that stand out, that you go, oh my god, that's exactly what I do wrong.
Great.
Okay, so because it'll stick, every good YouTube video I've seen, there is always a really good example in the video of saying, here is the swing fault, it looks something like X.
Yeah.
So if you video yourself, you've at least got a starting point to get the right advice for your game from the online. Try then one of the videos or couple of the videos you've got there of the ideas, because a couple of them might have different drills.
So mainly on technique.
On technique.
And would you break this down into, like, let's say a 20-minute section of your practice?
Yeah, I'd do 30 minutes.
Of technique only?
Of technique only. So it'll be 35 minutes in now, because your first bit was just hitting it. Then the next bit, I'd be then starting to put something in that's got an outcome into your practice. So I see everyone then start to work through the bag. I don't think that's the way to do it. I would be very specific in how you'll monitor how well you're doing. So hitting balls at a target at this point now, where it's going to be how many do you get on the target? Can you evaluate what you're doing? And then putting a score on it. So basically, you almost at the end of it, put a bit of pressure testing into your practice, which will simulate what you're going to do on the golf course. Because reality is, no one cares about your score on the course. It's only you. So your pressure is only internal. So can you create something like that at the end of the practice session that simulates it? And then you can also then see, did the stuff that you were working on earlier stand up to any of that pressure?
Yeah.
And if you record it, just a little note in your phone, I hit towards this target at, let's say it was 4 drivers down a fairway here. How many did I hit in that fairway? How many went in the rough? Then towards the green, how many did this? And then proximity with a wedge. Write that down, and then next week, do the same test. And then after you've done a month of that, you get where you are. Then change the test, because you just get bored with doing the same one all the time. If you're somebody who's got more time and they say, I want to do because we're saying they've got 2 hours a week, but let's say they've got three, I'd have two different types of tests and I'd do the range twice. And then the other hour you've got spare, I'd do it all on short game.
And a similar breakdown on short game?
100%, yeah.
What, let's say a 20-minute technique area or 30-minute technique only?
I like to do it like this. So I start off with is, to start off with, just hitting shots at getting the strikes. Are you controlling the landing of the club? Are you controlling the low point? Can you then mess about and just hit different shots? Okay, right. That would be just getting a feel. So doing that, just not even aiming at a target. Then, is there a shot that you really struggle with? Yeah, right. Then work at the technique on that by tipping the balls out. Once you've hit 30, 40 of those, you're probably going to be about 30 minutes in now. Then pick all the balls up, take four balls around the green with you, okay? And it's going to be from different positions, just throw a ball down to a flag, right? Play one to that flag, so it's got to be very much outcome-based. Then have another one to another flag, but from the same spot. All four, different types of flights that you've got to play, different types of shots. Pick those up, last 10 minutes, do a test.
And record your test again on your phone 100%, or your notepad,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, because if you, let's say it's in a comp that you start to then struggle for strike, but generally when it's just you're just having a mess about, you're always really good. Well, simulate that by putting a bit more pressure on it. Almost be sort of, let's say you've got something that you don't want to do it when you get home, or something that you hate doing. It's like, well, if I don't score X, I've got to go and do this, because you're only accountable to yourself. So it's up to you whether you want to cheat it or not. You know,
if I don't score X, I've got to wash the car, or
yeah, wash the dishes, or you know, I've got to, you know. The next nappy change, I'm not going to suddenly be on a phone call. I've got to actually be there for that one, you know, because who wants to deal with a pooey nappy? No one, you know, right, I've got to do, you know, that sort of stuff. So it's just creating that accountability for it, that if you fail, okay, have an outcome to it.
Good advice.
Very good advice.
We've got quick fire questions. We're 1:30 at the moment.
Well, I'm dying for the toilet.
Okay.
So we can either have a quick pause or...
Let's...
We've done a lot of the questions throughout, really. I've kind of been dripping them in.
That sounds good. Thanks, Dan.
Pleasure.
Might do a part two down the line. I thought there was lots of good advice. Yeah, I think we're good.
Sorry if I've ruined that because I had the Wii. But I think it was a nice ending.
It was a really good ending. I think an hour and a half, which is amazing.
Where can people find Dan? That's an important factor.
Where can people find you, Dan?
In terms of online and really...
You don't have to give your home address, obviously.
Yeah, so online, got YouTube channel, so if you should put my name in, should just come up.
When did you start that, by the way? Last question here.
Oh, yeah.
Because you were doing it before I was doing it.
Yeah, 2009. Oh, that's actually quite a cool, look, funny story. I'll bore you for 20 seconds on it. You'll quite like this one. So, you know, it's when people say, can you do something? And I'm really bad at saying no. So this guy from New York had this thing called the Gotham Golf Blogs, when blogs were like the thing, yeah. And you had like golf WRX forums and all this sort of stuff. So he said, could you do a video? Yeah, of course I can, mate, no problems. Okay, well, we could do an instruction one, yeah. So didn't know how to edit, didn't have a clue on anything. There wasn't even editing software about. So the first video I did is even had me press the recorder, walk away. Had me walking away from it, and it's got that really grim start. Hi, I'm Dan Whittaker. Like, it's like the most stale, boring start you've ever seen.
It was like 12 years ago.
Is that how long it was?
That's like that, on your channel, you've got videos from 12 years ago. A lot of them are just swings, like, from different angles. I'm not sure when your first actual YouTube video was.
Well, I actually gave all the stuff originally, because monetization wasn't about. So I gave everything to this guy called Ralph Perez, who owned this Gotham Golf blog. And then what he did, like an idiot, is he started putting all Golf Channel content on his page. And he said, if you keep doing this, we're going to take your site down. If you keep doing this, we're going to take your site down. Boom, site went down.
Oh.
I remember he had a video on there where... it was actually great for me, for the standpoint of people coming for lessons, but it was the first time I'd ever had any experience where people were just giving you loads of stick. So Luke Donald was world number one at the time, and I did an analysis of his swing and basically just said, he's great with irons, but he can't hit it off the tee, and here's why. Kind of in a nutshell, gets his two inside, flips it with a hand, so he's using that to square the face. And then all these people, oh my God, do you not even know what you're talking about? Who is this guy? This guy's world number one. Bet you can't even play. You know, all those sort of comments. I was like, oh, I feel like I'm getting a bit
YouTube not changed.
I've ruffled some feathers. That's good. So they can check you out on YouTube?
YouTube. Instagram is at dwhitakergolf, and I'm based at Highley. If they go on my website, it's got all my contact details on there, which is danwhitakergolf.com.
A full for 5 years, and you've got to be off plus five.
Yes.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for your time. Like I say, we'll try and do a part two again in the future. And thanks for all your help last week to help me play better golf. And I'm excited about playing again next week in a new Break 75.
Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks, buddy.
Cheers.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.